is a great appetite, and I mean a very strong appetite, for background checks. And I think we can bring up background checks like we've never had before. I think both Republican and Democrat are getting close to a bill on to doing something on background checks.
And that's President Trump at the White House today before departing for Dayton and El Paso. He added that there's no political appetite for banning assault weapons, however. But gun control measures are picking up steam in Congress, and not just among Democrats. South Carolina Republican Senator Lindsey Graham is pushing legislation to help states enact so-called red flag laws. These would allow law enforcement to temporarily confiscate weapons from people deemed potentially dangerous. And in the House, Dayton Republican Michael Turner said he would support banning the sale of military-style weapons to civilians and putting limits on magazine capacity. Wendy Benjaminson joins us now to explain what all this gun control talk among Republicans adds up to. She's the politics and campaign coverage editor for Bloomberg, and it's good of you to join us today.
Happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
So how much are these two shootings, El Paso and Dayton, shifting how Republicans are thinking about gun control? I mean, is this a true turning point or political spin in the wake of a crisis?
Well, it's hard to tell. After the Newtown shooting in which an elementary school was shot up, after Parkland in which a high school was shot up and more people were killed, everyone thinks this has got to be it. This is going to be the point where gun control becomes palatable to Republicans. And it didn't happen then. However, I think the horrific body count in 24 hours and the sort of political screed that one of the shooters put out may push Republicans toward accepting some gun control. And in that clip you just played of the president, he's beginning to give them some cover for that. He's saying, as the head of the Republican Party, it's okay to look at background checks. So that's a step in the direction toward gun control.
Well, Congress just started its August recess, though. Won't this just fade over the course of the summer as so much of the urgency kind of peters out?
It certainly could, but I think there may be enough noise around this that it could last past Labor Day unless something else big happens.
Well, looking at the political climate, though, is that substantially different than those other cases? And you were referring to Sandy Hook earlier. Hasn't gun control been a factor in some of the changes that we saw in these traditionally Republican-leaning districts back in the 2018 midterms? I mean, there was at least one upset in Georgia last year, right? And that
That's right,
came
absolutely.
Just after Parkland.
Mm-hmm. That's right, Barb. And in 2018, I have some numbers here for you, by a 22% margin, voters favored stricter gun control, and that was just a year ago. And of those who favored gun control, 76% backed Democrats. And we saw a number of Republicans lose their House seats and Senate seats in 2018, maybe partly because of that. Now, Republicans see these numbers, too, and they realize that if they want to keep those crucial swing states, those crucial suburban women, they are going to have to move a little on gun control. They are also benefited by somewhat of a diminution of the National Rifle Association, the once all-powerful NRA. I mean, they've had a leadership scandal. They were tied to a Russian spy, Maria Butina. They are not raising money like they were before because in the Trump era, people who want to support the NRA are confident that gun control won't happen. And so they're not sending their money to the NRA in terms of urgency like they used to. So the NRA doesn't have the power it once did to prevent these sort of moves.
And I want to go back to something you just mentioned. Could you put a finer point on how Republicans are splitting along different lines and into different factions on gun control? You mentioned suburban women. We've certainly seen that here in California and Orange County, where Republican women in the suburbs turned blue because of this issue in large part. But how are you seeing the pockets shifting?
Well, I think it is the suburban women who, were more worried about the economy and those sort of pocketbook issues and taxes in 2016. And those women are educated. They care about their children if they have them. They are working women largely. And those women don't like to see, I'm sorry to be gross about this, but they don't like to see piles of dead children after these shootings or think about, should I let my child leave the house? And so I think those women are advocating for gun control, and I think that could push the Republican Party.
And where are Republicans in danger if they do go on to support some gun control measures?
Well, I think it's those suburbs, and I think it's swing states where Republicans are being affected by Trump's trade policy, by his speech, by his attitudes that seem to turn some people off. And if they don't address a key issue like gun control in some way, whether it's the red flag law may be enough for some people, the background checks may be enough for some people, the ban on assault weapons I think is going to be difficult because those rifles are also used for hunting. But I think if some steps are taken, that could preserve Republicans in those areas.
And switching to Democrats, how do you see them responding to this shifting of the Republican Party on gun control, especially in the campaign trail? What's been their message, and how are they trying to counter it?
They're all pretty unified about the need for stricter gun control. I think Joe Biden stands out a little bit because he knows what President Obama tried to do by executive action and sees that you really need Congress to get this done. The 2020 Democratic field has been shouting for the last few days that if Congress doesn't take care of this in their first 100 days, then they will take executive action and they will fix it. And unfortunately, Biden is right. There's just not that much a president can do on his or her own. You certainly can't ban assault rifles. You can't install background checks. You can nibble around the edges, which is what President Obama was left doing, changing regulations about sharing mental illness information. And the trouble with executive orders is that they can be undone. Trump undid an executive order that Obama did after, I believe, Newtown, that allowed the Social Security Administration to share mental illness information with the Department of Justice, which conducted background checks for gun purchases. So now the Social Security Administration cannot share mental illness information with the Department of Justice. And if a President Biden or a President Harris or a President Warren decided to do that by executive order, the next president, if he didn't like it, could undo it. So they really need Congress.
And what are the strategic considerations, though, for Democrats? Because there is this idea that Republicans can take the charge on the most tepid form of a red flag alert legislation. What's the play for Democrats?
Well, I think they have time to figure that out, honestly, Barbara. This is the Democratic primary season and the presidential race. The congressional races haven't really heated up yet. And so right now, the Democrats can just try to distinguish themselves as the most ardent gun control advocate in the field. But beyond that, there's not much they need to do at this point.
Well, thanks for this. I appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Wendy Benjaminson, politics and campaign coverage editor for Bloomberg. And thanks again. New allegations of sexual abuse and a cover-up in the Boy Scouts service this week. Lawyers for the group abused in scouting say there are more than 350 previously unreported predators and hundreds of new potential victims. In a lawsuit, they accuse the Boy Scouts of America, or BSA, of continuing a serious conspiracy to conceal and cover up abuse. The Boy Scouts say they've referred some of the newly accused to law enforcement and are currently investigating the others. Allegations of suspected abuse in the Boy Scouts have now reached massive numbers, roughly 8,000 suspected abusers and over 12,000 victims dating back many, many decades. Joining us to talk about this is Kayla Epstein, reporter for The Washington Post, and thanks for taking the time.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
So just to clarify, why are we hearing about these new cases now? Because the abuse scandal came to light in 2012 due to reporting by the LA Times.
Right. So this is the latest in a long history of lawsuits that have been brought against the Boy Scouts by former members who alleged that they were sexually abused during their time in the Scouts. But what has brought this case now is that there were reports a few months ago, back in December, that the Boy Scouts were considering entering into bankruptcy. And what that would mean for possible victims would be that if they were to enter into a Chapter 11 bankruptcy, it would create a very narrow window for people to ever come forward and get some kind of justice or compensation. And so these lawyers with a group called Abused in Scouting, which is a handful of lawyers who have teamed up from across the country to handle these cases, said we might only have a narrow opportunity to get justice for people that have not come forward. And so what they started to do was they started to run television ads around the country saying, this has happened to you. Come talk to us. We want to hear your story. Come help protect the next generation of Boy Scouts. And so far, they say they've been contacted by about 800 people. They have several hundred clients at this point. And they have decided to bring one lawsuit from one victim now. But within that lawsuit, which is claiming that the Boy Scouts were negligent, that they covered up this issue, these lawyers have also revealed that they have about 350 cases that did not appear in previously published records of sexual abuse in the Boy Scouts.
Okay, so this is the first of a possible cascade of lawsuits, perhaps. But this one is just, as you say, about one victim. What do we know about him?
So we don't know his name. He's known only as SD. But we know that beginning when he was about 12 or 13 years old, when he was a Boy Scout at a camp in Pennsylvania, he began to be sexually assaulted by an assistant scoutmaster. And this happened for about 4 years. And it involved, you know, grooming. It involved, you know, some horrible forms of assault. And in the lawsuit, it mentions that he went through psychological, emotional, physical turmoil. But he never told his story until now. So him coming forward to the Abused in Scouting lawyers was the first time he has ever told this story.
So this goes back to the 1970s. And is he alleging that the Boy Scouts put him at risk? Because the lawsuit makes the case that the Scouts were negligent in protecting boys from potential abusers.
Yes. So the lawsuit names the Boy Scouts, it names the local council, and it names the alleged abuser as the defendants. And what they are saying primarily, though, is that the Boy Scouts conspired to cover up their well-known problem of sexual abuse. They didn't properly inform parents or scouts about the danger, and therefore they couldn't make decisions for themselves to protect themselves. It claimed that they were negligent in doing anything about preventing abuse, like what had happened to SD when he was a scout at camp.
And apparently the BSA kept these detailed files that they called of potential predators that they called ineligible volunteers.
Yes. So for a long time, the Boy Scouts have been keeping these files as sort of a blacklist for scoutmasters, assistant scoutmasters, volunteers, employees that have been suspected or confirmed of committing sexual assaults against boys. But these are secret files. The Boy Scouts keep them internally. And we've been able to see pieces of these secret files through lawsuits, through investigations, but we still can't see all of them.
So you're calling them secret files. Did the Boy Scouts confer or work with law enforcement at all? And now the Boy Scouts are claiming that they've referred many of these newly accused to law enforcement. So what do we know about what happened prior to this, and do we even know if that is true?
So what I can speak to is what they have told me in response to this story is that it is their policy to report any cases of suspected abuse to law enforcement. So they say that they have received these allegations from the Abused in Scouting lawyers and that they have passed about 120 of them on to law enforcement for review. They also say that, you know, some of these allegations don't have complete information, which makes sense. A lot of them happened decades ago, but they don't have complete names of an abuser. They don't have a troop number. And so they say that they're also reviewing these other cases and trying to see if they can find out any more information about them. And the Boy Scouts have implemented some measures to prevent this from continuing to happen. They have a training program for their volunteers, for scouts, for parents, where they're trained to recognize potential dangers about assault. They have a hotline where you can call in and say, say if you have an allegation or if you suspect something. But at the same time, what the lawyers that are bringing this lawsuit argue is that the Boy Scouts historically have not sufficiently handled these, because if there are all these cases that have never been reported, that have never been uncovered, what else do we not know?
Well, for victims, there's statutes of limitation around the country for these kinds of claims. How does that complicate matters?
Right. Well, that is the interesting part. So in the wake of Me Too, Time's Up, some of these other movements and an increasing awareness about sexual assault in society and, you know, the public's really coming to grips with this issue, several states have enacted these new windows that are opening up for victims of sexual abuse to come forward after the original statute of limitations has expired. So in New York, they're going to open up a one-year window for people who previously would have been denied justice an opportunity to come forward and bring their claims. New Jersey's done a similar thing. California recently signed a law that would extend the statute of limitations for sexual assault. And so in a lot of these states, people who may not have previously had an opportunity to seek justice for what happened to them might actually be getting a new opportunity. And so that also provides another chance for some people to come forward.
Well, Kayla, thank you very much for your reporting.
All right. Well, thank you very much for having me on.
And thanks for this. Kayla Epstein, reporter for The Washington Post. Coming up, the Trump administration wants to make it harder for people to qualify for food stamps, and Californians would be among the hardest hit. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Barbara Bogave. If you receive food stamps, you're living on the economic margins, and the stamps usually just give you that extra boost to keep enough in the pantry for your family. But not everyone agrees that food stamp recipients really need them. The Trump administration is now pursuing rule changes for who qualifies for the stamps. These changes could take more than 3 million Americans off the rolls. For more on this, we're joined on Press Play by Jackie Botts. She's a journalist at CalMatters working for the California Divide, examining income inequality and economic survival in California. And it's good to have you on the show.
Great to be here. Thanks so much.
And so first, just to clarify, here in California, we have a state version of the federal food stamps program, which is called CalFresh. So what qualifies someone to receive CalFresh benefits right now?
Yeah, so in California, you can get CalFresh if your total household income is up to double the federal poverty limit, as long as you have hefty expenses that bring your disposable income to below the federal poverty limit.
Okay, so different rules regulate who gets what. And what would change in California with the changes that the Trump administration is seeking?
Yeah, so the federal government actually has different rules for who can get food stamps, and they're more restrictive than California's rules. According to the federal government, your household can't have a combined income much above the income of the federal poverty line. You also can't have savings and assets above a certain limit, and that's about $2,250 for most families. But there's this pathway that states can and have taken to raise the income threshold, and they can even get rid of the asset limit, and that's what California has done. But this proposal would essentially realign all of the states back with that more restrictive federal rule for who can get food stamps. So it's sort of like a one-size-fits-all states rule for the entire country.
So like a reset. And the Western Center on Law and Poverty ran the numbers on this, on how many Californians would lose CalFresh benefits if the changes go into effect. So what's the number?
The number right now is that over 250,000 people would lose their food stamps in California under this proposal, and we're expecting an estimate from the California State Department of Social Services soon.
And how does that compare with other states? And I'm thinking that you're right that California would be especially hard hit. So flesh that out for us, because it has to do with just how expensive the cost of living is here, right, and housing compared to other states.
Right. Yeah, this would hit California particularly hard for a few reasons. So remember, the households that are going to get cut are those mostly working households that have slightly higher incomes, but also comparatively higher expenses when it comes to rent and childcare and medical expenses. And here in California, we have a lot of people who fall into that bucket. Those are low-income workers in California who tend to have higher incomes than low-income workers in the rest of the country. And that's because our lawmakers have lifted the minimum wage because of our very high cost of housing and other basic expenses here. But the idea when California actually increased the income limit and got rid of that asset test for food stamps was that even with a higher income, a California family might still have need for food assistance after they pay for all of the essentials.
Wow. So that is just kind of a perfect storm of a mess for these Californians whose incomes come close to that federal poverty line. California's attorney general has sued the Trump administration already some 50 times, and now his office says they're monitoring the president's actions on this front. What do you expect will happen?
That's a great question. So we'll have to wait and see, first of all. Attorney General Becerra is not going to do anything until the Trump administration comes to a determination about whether they actually enact this proposed rule. And right now, there's a whole process that is, now that they've publicized the rule, they now have opened it to 60 days of public comment. After that closes, they read all those comments and decide what to do next. And at that point, I think we can be looking at what the Attorney General's office does.
Well, this story gets so real when you talk to people desperately worried about their benefits and you know, about this difference between eating and starving, really, which is what this could come down to. And you have talked to a number of people. Why don't you tell us about Antoinette Martinez?
Antoinette Martinez lives in Santa Cruz County. She's a single mom, and she works at her local food bank, actually helping other people sign up for food stamps. But between herself and her five-year-old son, their household is also eligible for CalFresh. So she brings in about $2,380, she says, each month, and that leaves her eligible for about $100 in CalFresh, but she's right in that bracket of people who would stand to lose their benefits under the Trump proposal.
And what does she say about that? What does that mean to her?
To her, it means that things are going to get tighter. Right now, the way that they shop is that they're very much budgeting their monthly expenses to about $100 that they get on their EBT card each month from CalFresh. So, you know, it would mean rethinking her finances and finding another way to pay for food.
That is so close to the bone. And you're also looking at another aspect of this food stamps issue, which is that even with the CalFresh program as it is, you write that many who are eligible aren't receiving their benefits. Why is that?
California has a participation rate in food stamps that is fifth to the bottom across the country. According to the last count, we only get food stamps to about 72% of people who are eligible, which is pretty darn low. There are other states that are up at 100%. There's a whole host of reasons. It has to do with who lives in our state, a lot of people with immigration concerns. It has to do with a lack of consistent messaging and awareness. And it has to do with the fact that every county in California administers the program slightly differently. So it's been hard to legislate or make statewide changes to how the program works.
Okay. Jackie Botts is a journalist with the nonprofit Cal Matters. Thank you so much, Jackie, for your reporting and for this.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, plastic is one of the biggest environmental problems. So why not go the refillable route with home cleaning products?
You'd need a fewer number of boats and trucks to ship them around, so that saves on emissions. And you can reduce the amount of plastic packaging because you have smaller containers.
The brave new world of just add water, detergents, shampoos, and soaps. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Barbara Bogave.
Recycle, reduce, reuse, and close the loop. We can close the loop.
Well, Californians have been told for decades to make recycling a priority. But even with our state's green reputation, a surprising trend has emerged. Recycling centers, those places where you bring your bottles and cans and get cash in return, they're closing. This week, nearly 300 of those centers were shut down across the state, and 750 workers were laid off. To give us the latest on this, we have Susan Collins joining us. She's president of the Container Recycling Institute, and she's with us from NPR in Culver City. It's good to talk with you, Susan.
Thank you for having me.
So why is this company, it's called Replanet, closing some 284 recycling centers and going out of business?
Replanet is the latest casualty in this this series of problems that the state program has had with an underfunded infrastructure. The state's redemption centers collectively have been underpaid by $62 million over the last 5 years. And recycling advocates in the state have been warning the state leadership, the legislature, and CalRecycle that this is an untenable situation, as we've watched more than 1,000 redemption centers close up to this point, and then the 284 centers that closed on Monday were on top of that 1,000. So at this point, 53% of the centers that existed in 2013 have gone out of business due to problems with the state payment formula and the fact that it is not keeping up with other problems in the industry where they're getting lower revenue from lower scrap values and having to pay out higher costs as the minimum wage has increased in the state.
Okay, but Governor Newsom has included an additional $5 million subsidy in the new budget for low-volume recyclers, and you've called on politicians to bring in more money. Why isn't there enough in the system, and why hasn't that happened? There was a bill by State Senator Ben Allen.
Yeah, and much to our frustration, that bill failed at the last minute for reasons completely unknown. It was going through committee after committee, and it was being passed. And at the last minute, it just didn't come up for a vote in its last committee. The $5 million is wonderful, but it's nowhere near enough. The redemption centers are falling short by about $20 or $30 million a year collectively, not five. So while we welcome the $5 million, it didn't make up for even current year losses, much less the sustained losses over the last several years for the redemption centers. And we're baffled as to why the legislature and the governor and CalRecycle haven't taken more bold action to correct this situation, because the reserve fund has $300 million in it. So there's more than enough money there to solve this problem.
I thought that our recycling crisis in across the nation is because Asian countries have stopped buying our recyclables. Is that just a gross oversimplification? Because you're mentioning all sorts of other issues that are coming into play.
Right. There's so much confusion around that because people think of recycling as being all one thing. In reality, it is a series of different commodity markets. And the aluminum market is different from the cardboard market, which is different from the glass market. And what we're looking at here, just for the beverage container recycling, that's a combination of aluminum and glass and PET plastic, which is the kind of plastic that's used to make soda bottles and water bottles. And for those three commodities, they all are handled with the domestic infrastructure here in the United States. And as a matter of fact, one of the great things about our beverage container deposit law in California is that we've provided subsidies to build PET processing centers in California. So we have the best infrastructure in the nation for handling PET plastic right here in California. So China isn't really our problem for this program. It is a huge problem for curbside recycling all around the nation.
Okay, so what do these closures mean? What do they mean for the state? What do they mean for consumers? Where do we take our bottles and cans?
Right. You know, it's like you were saying in the previous segment, talking about a perfect storm and things that hit the low-income consumers the hardest. That's what's happening here. If your local neighborhood redemption center closes, you either have to go farther away to get your refunds back, or you might be discouraged altogether because it may not be worth it to go farther away to get your refunds back. And again, that would hit the lower income consumers the hardest.
And where does that leave me? Am I going to start paying as a taxpayer more for the recycling program in California? How am I going to recycle? Should I even be recycling? I mean, we're about to have a conversation about plastic, and given the current state of recycling here, you know, should I be reducing my plastic waste or just avoiding plastic use whenever possible?
Well, we should always be reducing waste as a first step. All of us should be doing that all the time. This program is a fantastic program for recycling at the very highest quantity levels and the very highest quality levels. So as consumers, if we can, we should be returning our containers to redemption centers. Materials that go into our curbside bin, like glass, can have 25 to 50% contamination in it, and it makes it very hard for that glass to be turned back into a bottle again. Whereas if that same glass goes through a container deposit program where it's kept clean and separated from other materials, it can be 98% pure and go back into glass bottles that are made right here in California, which is another aspect of this, that this program has a ripple effect on all of those industries that take back this material and create manufacturing jobs right here in California and provide the raw material we need to make our plastic and glass bottles and cans in California.
Well, thank you very much. I enjoyed talking with you. Thanks.
Thanks for having us.
Susan Collins, president of the Container Recycling Institute. Well, pick up any cleaning product in your house, and the first ingredient in it will almost certainly be water. In some cases, water can make up more than 90% of household cleaners, like detergent or floor cleaner or shampoo. So, as we're thinking about ways to use less plastic and throw fewer things away, maybe the easiest way to do that is to sell cleaners without the water, just to distill them down to their active ingredients. That is the idea behind a growing environmental push to sell more waterless products. Joining us to talk about this Just Add Water push is Alden Wicker. She wrote about it for Vox. Hi there.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
It's wonderful to have you on the show. Now, run down for us the benefits of selling these kinds of products without the water, aside from, you know, they're smaller and easier to carry.
Well, they're not only smaller and easier for us to carry. If you shrink them down to just their active ingredients, you just need a fewer number of boats and trucks to ship them around. So that saves on emissions. They weigh less. That also saves on fuel and carbon emissions. And you can reduce the amount of plastic packaging because you have smaller containers, or because you don't have water in them, so the packaging doesn't need to be waterproof, you could get rid of all of the plastic altogether for the refills.
All of it altogether. So I was going to ask you, how much could selling cleaning products like this cut down on plastic waste? And you're saying go down to zero waste?
Yeah. And if you tabletize something, so if you take it and you put it into a tablet that you can drop into water at home, then you can ship out that tablet in compostable packaging, which is what one of the brands that I tested, Blue Land, does.
Oh, and I was going to say, what companies are actually doing this besides Blue Land? I mean, are there any companies beyond like startups and environmentally conscious brands? Is this moving into the mainstream?
Well, I haven't seen any new tabletized products from some of the mainstream companies. What they're doing is they are just concentrating their formulas so that they ship a smaller and smaller amount or volume of liquid out to customers. That's not to say that that doesn't exist, because the thing is that there's this new wave that's around environmentalism, but of course, we've had Just Add Water products since the beginning of time. Antacids, tea, coffee, all of these different things have always come in Just Add Water things. So this, it kind of seems like a marketing ploy, but it still has value, I think.
Well, all right, let's hear about them, because you did try out one company for this story, the company you mentioned, Blue Land. So how was it?
It was great. I mean, I have to say that the Blue Land products, I think part of their appeal is that it's just the most beautiful and aesthetically pleasing cleaning product company I have ever come across. And you drop the tablets in, and I use them on, so they have three products. They have the glass cleaning product, they have like a sort of an all-purpose cleaner, and they have a bathroom cleaner. And I thought they worked pretty well.
And the active ingredients, they're sustainable?
Yeah, they're completely non-toxic. Blue Land has been certified by the Cradle to Cradle Foundation, which covers sort of not only how things are made and how they're disposed of when you're done with them, but also that the ingredients are non-toxic. So that's a pretty good sign that you're looking at something that's sort of on the cutting edge of sustainability and safety.
One thing I'm thinking about and looking kind of more at the bigger picture of this, because I've called it a trend, that I wonder how much of this trend or movement is being offset by other companies that weren't previously putting their products into plastic bottles, but now are. And I'm thinking some examples would be, for instance, Starbucks and other coffee companies that are now selling cold brew.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we're putting a lot of unnecessarily bottled products out into the world many, 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 many more times than we're taking away. So I think this is another instance of a consumer-led sustainability movement that just sort of very, very, it just nibbles around the edges of what is a really huge problem.
Well, yeah, there's so many things going on at once and competing. I mean, you have big companies like Johnson & Johnson, and they're spending so much time and so much money trying to figure out how to brand and maximize shelf space in order to get to catch shoppers' eye in the stores. And I wonder how much do we as consumers, though, also need to change in terms of our own shopping behaviors?
Yeah, well, if you'll notice, these new startups, they're all direct-to-consumer, and they're online, and they're subscription-based. And that's because when you shrink something down, you're losing eye space on a shelf, and companies actually pay for good shelf space. And that's why we have, on a lot of products, you know, people get really annoyed with the clamshell packaging, where you have, like, a little battery, and then it's in this giant plastic thing with a label. And that's because companies want you to be able to see it when you're walking down the aisle. And so if you're a consumer that's already comfortable with the idea of Amazon Prime or ordering things online and getting subscriptions, then these brands will be great for you. But I think that it's going to be hard for these companies, these conventional companies, Unilever, Johnson & Johnson, to shrink down their products and hold on to market share, even if it is probably the right thing to do.
Alden Wicker, she's a freelance journalist, and you can read her story about Just Add Water products in Vox. Fun to talk with you. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up on the show, the last installment on our travel series about overrun travel destinations, we'll meet the woman who literally wrote the book on overtourism. It's called Overbooked. And that's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Barbara Bogave. This summer, we've been looking at cities suffering because of over-tourism in a series we call Hashtag Stay Home.
This is no longer a vacation. It's a quest. It's a quest for fun.
If you want fun, then listen to this. New York's hottest club is Slice.
I want to go someplace where I can marvel at something.
Are we there yet?
Well, we've looked at the cruise ship traffic in Venice, tourists flocking to Dubrovnik to recreate scenes from Game of Thrones, jamming up the highway to Big Sur, and celebrity bus tours clogging up Hollywood streets. But now it's time to talk about some solutions. The answer isn't to stop traveling altogether. No way. But to travel more responsibly and respectfully. Elizabeth Becker is a journalist and author of the book Overbooked, The Exploding Business of Travel and Tourism. Condé Nast has named her one of the people changing the way we travel. And she's here to wrap up this series with some ideas for more sustainable, considerate travel. Welcome to the show. It's great to have you.
It's nice to be here.
Before we get to your suggestions, I would just like to get a fix on how huge the global tourism industry is. Let's talk some numbers. What's it worth and how many people are traveling each year?
It is worth at least $8 trillion, over 1.2 billion, that's B, billion international trips. And no one has been able to measure how many trips are taken within countries, but it's presumed it's at least three times more. So that would be 4 billion trips. And this has happened, just to also put this in perspective, until the end of the Cold War at the beginning of this century, half of the world wasn't open for travel. We didn't have the technological innovations we have now. We didn't have the growth of the middle class. So all of this has happened in just two decades, which is just a flea bite minute. And that's why we feel so overrun, because all of a sudden, all the people around the world who wanted to travel are traveling, and they're going everywhere.
So I mentioned the cities that we have chatted about in this series just a moment ago, Venice, Dubrovnik, Big Sur, and Hollywood. And guests we had on from each of these cities complained of traffic jams, overpriced restaurants, a shift in the local economy toward tourism. And most said tourism was turning their homes into an amusement park. So does all of that jive with what you're hearing from people in other popular destinations?
Yes, and can I add a couple to the list?
Oh, yeah. Go right ahead.
Well, you didn't mention the environmental degradation, and that's a huge part of it, that when you have not only the masses of people, but in terms of cruise ships, the pollution of the water and the air, and airplanes, the pollution of the air by that, but also within the local communities, it's destroying their local environment, their cityscape, their landscapes, and it's homogenizing so that it doesn't matter where you go in Europe or Asia or even Africa and sometimes the Middle East, you're going to be offered avocado toast. You're going to be shown shops that look just like the ones in Beverly Hills. The local culture is being denigrated and turned into this mishmash of international tourism.
And on the macro level, on the government level, a lot of destinations have, or some have developed strategies for controlling how many people get to come in. And for instance, in Peru, Machu Picchu limits the number of tours through the ruins. And I know Easter Island has also done that on its trails. So how widespread are measures like these, though?
Well, you mentioned two of the good ones, and they are spreading. And I can't underline this enough. As soon as a country or a location realizes they're dealing with an industry and not a hobby, they open up their minds. So there's an entire country, Bhutan, in the Himalayas, that figured this out a long time ago. It's what we used to call a development country that looked at tourism as an industry to make money to help their people improve with education, so on and so forth. So right away, they limited the number of people. They made the demand that they spend at least $250 a day on their hotel, et cetera, and they had to pay it in advance. They made sure that when they got there, they were hiring locals, that they went to local establishments, and it's been an amazing success.
Well, switching over, looking at things from the point of view of travelers, what are some of the most doable things that someone can do who wants to see more of the world but wants to see it sustainably?
I think most travelers really do have the best interest in mind for the place they're visiting, but they have to be careful about some things they may not have been thinking of, like Airbnb. When you rent an Airbnb, is it legal? Most people don't even, what's legal, illegal? Well, most cities and countries are trying to deal with Airbnbs that don't meet the standards that they are trying to apply. Barcelona, afflicted with all kinds of over-tourism. A lot of it comes from having people renting out their rooms or their entire apartments to tourists, and they don't have permission to do it from the city. So Barcelona is shutting down an illegal Airbnb, at least one every day, and they've been doing it for years, and they still can't control it. So if you want to be conscientious, make sure that your Airbnb or home away, whatever it is, does fit the local criteria.
And secondly, how do you do that? I mean, that's not an easy thing to do necessarily.
Say, Roberta Smith has an Airbnb you want to rent in Seattle, and you say, okay, Roberta, does this follow the Seattle guidelines, and can you show me proof of this? Bingo. If you are going to take a cruise ship, go on Friends of the Earth website and see what the report card is on the cruise line. Then there's the old school approach, and that is take your time in planning and preparing for your trip. Don't just read guidebooks. Read real books about history, modern politics, novels, mysteries, even cookbooks, because the more you prepare yourself for this new adventure, be it a new culture, or a new city in your country, or a new culture, the smarter you're going to be and you'll know yourself. Your instincts are going to be so much better, and you'll be able to avoid the tourist traps. You'll be able to see what is truly local, and you'll have a much better vacation. And then once you get there, stay there. Do not try to have, you know, five cities in 5 days. Stay in one place. I think 2 weeks at one place is ideal, but most people don't plan their trips that way. And finally, don't take so many trips. Take those longer trips once in a while.
Make them quality. What are some cities that are overlooked and eager to have tourists stop by?
Okay, my favorite is the city of Bordeaux in France. I've written love letters in my book and in subsequent articles because the vineyards, of course, always famous, everybody visiting, but the city itself, which used to be an 18th century jewel, was a mess. They've recaptured the beauty and the everything about it, food, et cetera, et cetera.
Lovely. And if you could give us a lightning round of cities like Bordeaux?
I always send people to Canada.
And me too. I just went to Toronto. Fabulous.
Okay. That's instead of New York. Victoria, for the essential, the whole island, you have the island at your feet. And then Vancouver, which I'm from Seattle, and I've always admired the way Vancouver works, things work in Vancouver. Then Edinburgh in the British Isles, overlooked. In Spain, Toledo. The light is almost as beautiful as in Jerusalem. And, you know, people who are not quite ready for Germany, try Strasbourg in Alsace. And then once you get to Germany, go down the rivers and follow the vineyards, which are overlooked. The German wine is fabulous. And then in the United States, Providence, Rhode Island. I already mentioned Savannah, Charleston, South Carolina, of course. And then in the Midwest, Traverse City is often forgotten, and that's very cool. I think a large town that I like is Cannon Beach, Oregon.
Uh-huh.
And I'll throw one in there that just because I hate to even say this, but I was surprised at what a good place Las Vegas was.
Well, you can have a lot of fun in Las Vegas. Well, Elizabeth Becker, I can't even imagine staying home another second. I want to thank you very much for this.
That's the problem, isn't it? I mean, we're not talking about the oil industry, are we?
No, that's true.
Yes.
Thanks again.
Thank you. This has been fun.
Elizabeth Becker, she's journalist, author, and over-tourism expert. And that is the music I associate with Michelle Alloy, and you are here.
I am here.
Do you have feedback?
Well, we were going to talk a little bit about these places that she does recommend us visit.
Fantastic.
Yeah. I've been to Toledo. Oddly enough, I live in Georgia for 3 years and never went to Savannah. It's just could never.
Oh, really? Even I've been to Savannah.
I know. It was beautiful. Always like just the wrong, like you couldn't go during St. Patrick's Day because it's like a madhouse down there. And then the other times of the year, it's just like too hot. And
yeah, I was surprised she said that because I think of it as a very tourist-heavy city.
Yeah, same.
Right?
Right. That's how I always thought about it. Our producer on the segment too said she didn't say it in the segment, but also mentioned Chicago, which is where I'm from. And I can strongly endorse that they're looking for tourism, they're looking for business, great museums, great food, Oh, it's
fantastic architecture.
Oh,
I can
do
that boat architecture tour
sit on
over
that
and over again. I could do that all day.
For days.
Yeah, I said I just went to Toronto.
Oh.
Beautiful city, the most diverse city in North America.
You know what? I've been to some places. I've been to Canada, but not those places. So there's on my list.
Time to plan the next trip. Mm-hmm. Thank you for that. Thank you, everyone, for listening. And remember, you can download or subscribe to the Press Play podcast and listen whenever you want on Apple Podcasts or at kcrw.com/pressplay or wherever else you get your podcasts. I'm Barbara Bogave. Thanks for listening. I'll see you tomorrow.